Better?
All right. Not too loud. All right. I did actually read a novel by Alvin Toffler. And in this book, Toffler defines the term future shock as a certain psychological state of individuals and entire societies. His shortest definition for the term is a personal perception of too much change in too short a period of time. I think we can relate to that, especially today. Toffler stated that also that that he used it, or pardon me, he coined the term, or at least popularized the term, information overload. And when we look back in the 1970s, information overload, who ever heard of that? You know, but he was projecting 1985. So we've come a long way since 1985. But to kind of put things in its perspective, if we go back to 1970 when Toffler wrote this book, there were virtually no such things as computers, or nothing that we would even consider a computer by today's standards. We did have some very large computers that operated on vacuum tubes, and I know there's many here who don't even know what a vacuum tube is. But these were computers that, by today's standards, we wouldn't even consider them a computer. And vacuum tubes, certainly in the technological world we have today, are considered prehistoric. Back in the 1960s, we actually did send men to the moon. And we did have some very primitive computers. And just to kind of put that in perspective, they claim that the little chips, this minute little chip that we have inside of a talking greeting card, one that you can pick up at Walmart and you can record a message on, has more computing power than the computers that landed men on the moon. Hard to imagine, but that's how primitive we were technologically in the 1960s and 70s. Personal computers certainly hadn't been invented yet, and the idea that anybody would even want a personal computer was unthinkable. When I was growing up, the concept of information overload was never a thought. For us old-timers, we remember Encyclopedia Britannica. How many people had an Encyclopedia Britannica set in their home? Wow. They sold them door to door and you paid for them on a payment plan because it was pretty pricey. It was a luxury to actually have Encyclopedia Britannica in your home. Most of us went to the school library to browse through them. But Encyclopedia Britannica was basically like considered the storehouse of all knowledge, all events that had happened up till this date. And it was conveniently all in 15 volumes. So we've come a long way since Encyclopedia Britannica. And as technology begins to evolve, some of the early leaders of technology revolution made predictions. Some of them seemed to make sense, obviously, at the time, but today they're virtually laughable. One, for example, Ken Olson, the founder of Digital Computer or Digital Equipment Corporation, which later became a major computer manufacturer. I think they're out of the computer business now, but he made a statement that there is no reason that anyone would ever want a computer in their home. Well, we can understand why they went out of business. Alex Lute, and this is another one. I've never heard of Lute Vacuum Cleaners, but Alex Lute was president of Lute Vacuum Cleaner Company. And in 1955, he said, nuclear-powered vacuum cleaners will probably be a reality within 10 years. Well, maybe he's tried producing one. Maybe after he glowed in the dark for a while, he decided that wasn't such a good idea after all. You know, but when we look back in the 50s and 60s, these kind of ideas, you know, we were looking at futuristic things, and some of the predictions that mankind made were pretty dumb. Now, the first personal computers began to emerge in the 1980s, and they used a very primitive, by today's standard, operating system called DOS. I don't know how many remember DOS. This was before we had Windows. I see at least one hand back here. You know, we didn't have Windows. We had a very basic operating system. But this operating system is what made Microsoft and certainly made Bill Gates one of the wealthiest men in the world. And Bill Gates made a statement, and he made the statement because DOS had limitations in its design, and DOS could only access 64K of memory. A lot of you don't know what 64K is, and that's not really important, but he made a statement, what could anybody possibly need more than 64K of memory for? Well, today, the average things we use, our laptops have about 1 million times more memory. Our smartphones have 100,000 more memory than that. So 64K is like this, you know. And at that time, it made perfect sense that 64K was more than enough for anyone. We can go back to 1899 when the commissioner of the U.S. Patent Office, suggesting that there was no longer a need for a patent office, said, everything that could be invented has already been invented. 1899. There was nothing on his horizon. It was over. Last week, we're going to change the subject here just a little bit. Last week, if you remember, Pastor Merle asked how many read the book of Revelation. And a lot of people raised their hands. Then he asked how many completely understood the book of Revelation. And of course, all the hands went down. Now, I've read the book of Revelation a few times, but certainly not as many times as I've studied many of the other books. And the reason being, it's difficult to understand. Few pastors ever talk about the book of Revelation because it's very difficult to understand, let alone try to explain it to others. And certainly, I'm not going to try and explain it here this morning, other than to look at some of the predictions, some of the prophecies contained in that book, and try and explain a little bit what John might have been trying to describe to us as he wrote that book. Well, first of all, and not really relevant to the book itself, but there is no real consensus among biblical scholars as to who wrote the book of Revelation. We clearly know it was a John. He states so in a couple of the sections in the book. It says, I, John, and John, on and on. So we know that a John wrote it. But we don't know that it was the Apostle John, the same John that wrote the Gospel of John. But I believe that it was. And I don't have any special knowledge. I'm not a biblical scholar. But I believe that the book of John was written by someone who knew Jesus very well, was very close to him, and really understood him probably better than most. And that certainly points to the Apostle John. Now, I remember the first time I read the book of Revelation straight through, and my first idea was that it sounded like it was written by someone on an LSD trip. You know? Now, I am not suggesting that John was on an LSD trip or on any other kind of drugs when he was writing this book. But when we look at the bizarre imagery that he talks about, you know, especially back then, you can imagine what people were thinking. But if we put that bizarre imagery into context with what a first or second century writer might be trying to describe something happening 1,000, 2,000 years into the future. He talked about fire being poured down from the heavens. We see this. This is a picture of a napalm bomb. Now, if John was describing something like that, he certainly had never seen anything like that ever before. We'd never heard of a bomb in the first century. We certainly never heard of gunpowder even. So these kind of concepts, when you think of how would somebody describe this in the first century? Then he also talks about fire burning up large swaths of the earth. And put yourself back in 100 AD and try and describe something like, say, the nuclear blast that wiped out Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. This is what Hiroshima looked like the day after the bomb. Now, if John had seen something like that, seen the fireball and then seen this, large swaths of the earth burned up, how could he put that in any kind of perspective? John also wrote, and out of the smoke, locusts came down upon the earth and were given power like that of scorpions of the earth. The locusts looked like horses prepared for battle. On their heads, they wore something like crowns of gold. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron, and the sound of their wings was like that of the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. They had tails and stings like scorpions. Now, think about what a swarm of attack helicopters, Apache helicopters, might look like to somebody in the first century. How might they try and describe that? A huge propeller whirling in the sunlight certainly might have looked like something like a crown of gold. It certainly looks like it's something made out of iron. And if you ever stood close to a running helicopter, or especially directly under one, the sound is certainly like the sound of the thundering of many horses and chariots rushing into battle. A long, long time ago, while I was in the service, I had the opportunity to fly in a very large helicopter, one that had twin propellers. And believe me, the noise that those spinning blades made was absolutely deafening. Now, I can't begin to tell you that this is what John saw. I don't know that he saw helicopters in his vision. But when we try to put that into perspective, look at somebody in the first century describing something so far off in the future with no frame of reference, it starts to make a little more sense. John talked about events that the whole world would see. When John was writing this, it would certainly have been absolutely impossible, unthinkable, that an event could happen somewhere in the world and the whole world could see it all at once. Not today. We have 24/7 satellite news being broadcast all over the world. We have the internet. So for an event to happen thousands of miles from here and the entire world see it all at once is commonplace today. People might have thought John was crazy. How could you imagine something like that? But when we look at the predictions and the descriptions of events and relate some of those to occurrences happening today, it starts to come together. Now, many people have used the predictions and the prophecies throughout the Bible to try and predict when the end would come. I think it's a waste of time. Jesus told us we will never know the hour or the day when he'll come. But people who think they're an awful lot smarter than I am continue to try. I don't think that the book of Revelation was meant to be some kind of cryptic code or riddle that if we really worked at it hard enough, we would figure it out and know when the end was coming. I believe that God's intention was merely to let us know that he indeed is in charge, that he clearly does know the future, and the future is something that he showed glimpses of to John. I have no intention of arguing with anybody that thinks differently about the book of Revelation. I can only relate to what it means to me. And we're going to take a little break here. We're going to see a little film clip from the movie Apocalypse.
Gospel of the Lord Jesus. We have nothing to fear, Charlie.
Good for you, Bill. Thanks for calling. This is Charlie Frost reporting live from Yellowstone National Park, soon to become the world's largest active volcano. I'll be right back, folks.
Do you mind if I join you? I wanted to ask you something.
Yeah, I only got a minute.
Hey,
Pickle?
No. I was listening to the broadcast, and I was wondering, what exactly is it that's going to start in Hollywood?
It's the apocalypse. End of days. The judgment day. The end of the world, my friend. Christians called it the rapture, but the Mayans knew about it. The Hopis, the I Ching, the Bible, kind of. Beer?
Yeah.
So look, I gotta eat. Why don't you download my blog? It's free. Of course, we do appreciate donations.
In ancient times, the Mayan people were the first civilization to discover that this planet had an expiration date. According to their calendar, in the year 2012, a cataclysmic event will unfold caused by an alignment of the planets in our solar system that only happens every 640,000 years.
Oh, not again.
Greenie, huh? I did all the animation myself.
Just imagine the Earth as an orange.
You lure them in with humor, then you make them think.
Our sun will begin to emit such extreme amounts of radiation.
Show your bastard you called neutrinos.
That the core of the Earth will melt at the inside part of the orange, leaving the crust of our planet free to shift. In 1958, Professor Charles Hapgood named it Earth Crust Displacement. Albert Einstein did support it. People will get it all. The forces of Mother Nature will be so devastating, it will bring an end to this world on winter solstice 12/21/12. Always remember, folks, you heard it first from Charlie Fox.
Remember, you heard it first from Charlie. No, I'm not predicting the end of the world, and I don't think that the Mayans had any information that they were privy to that the rest of us don't know. I don't believe that the world is going to end on 12/21/2012, which happens to be only 6 months away. I don't know why their calendar ended then. I don't know if they got tired of writing, if they ran out of paper, their pencil broke. I have no idea why the Mayans calendar ends then. We don't know that. But I wouldn't bank on it. I wouldn't go out and spend all my life savings between now and... Somebody already did. Oh, all right. But I wouldn't want to do that or run up a large credit card debt, assuming that on the 22nd I wasn't going to have to worry about it. My personal feeling is, and I'm absolutely not making a prediction, but I really believe that we are somewhere in the end times now. I don't think the end of the world is imminent. I don't think it's going to happen on the 21st of December of 2012, and probably not even next year. But if we look at Revelation, if we look at the prophecies, we see these things starting to take place. I think we're a lot closer to the end than we are to the beginning. But again, I'm not predicting 2012 as the end date. The Bible is full of predictions, and we could spend literally hours here going through all of them, and it's a little warm, we're probably not going to do that. Even if we just took a significant portion of the Bible prophecies, we could be here for hours. But the Bible, unlike so many of the prophecies by man, we can look at all these smart people like Bill Gates and all these people that made all these great predictions. The Bible has a 100% track record. Now, not all of the prophecies have taken place yet, but based on the fact that every one that's happened so far was predicted accurately, we can assume with a very high degree of certainty that all the predictions to come will also prove to be true. We don't have to look just to the book of Revelation for prophecies. The Bible is filled with prophecies. And in light of a lot of the Old Testament prophecies, think about how difficult it would be for someone today to predict the exact date and location where a future president, say a president who was going to be born 700 years from now, how could someone predict where he was going to be born and the date? But that's precisely what Micah did 700 years before the birth of Christ. How difficult do you think it would be to indicate the precise kind of death that a new unknown religious leader would experience 1,000 years from now? Could you predict and describe now a new method of execution not currently known, one that won't even be invented for hundreds of years? But David did that 1,000 BC when he wrote Psalm 22. And don't take my word for it. Look it up. It's there. Believe me. Or how difficult would it be to predict the specific date and the appearance of some great future leader hundreds of years in advance, but the prophet prophet Daniel did 530 years before Christ. And in Daniel 9:26, he actually even predicted the death of Christ. Now, think about this. If you could think up 50 specific prophecies about anyone, pick up someone that was going to be born sometime in the future, someone that you would never meet, it would be very difficult to find one man who could fulfill all those prophecies. And how hard would it be if 25 of those predictions were about other people and what they would do to him? Things that were totally out of this person's control. How could someone arrange to be born into a specific family? How does someone arrange in advance to have his parents give birth to him in a specific city, not his own? How does one arrange to be born to a virgin? How does one arrange to be considered a prophet like Moses? How does someone arrange his own death, including being put to death by this strange new method of execution, and being put to death not alone, but with company? Specifically, two criminals, and then arrange to have his executioners gamble for his clothing during his execution. All prophesied hundreds of years before Christ was born. Now, it might be possible to fake one or two of these, but it would be absolutely impossible to arrange and fulfill all these predictions in advance. And if it can be proved that these statements were predicted of the Messiah hundreds of years in advance, and one man fulfilled all of them, then that man, that one man, would logically have to be the Messiah. God gave a great number of prophecies about Christ for at least two reasons, probably many more reasons, but at least two. First, it would make identifying him obvious. And second, it would also make it impossible for an imposter. Anyone can make predictions, that's easy. Having them fulfilled, that's an entirely another story. The more statements you make about the future, the greater the detail, the more likely that you'll be wrong. Now, recently, a person who shall remain unnamed told my grandson, Sam, that the Pittsburgh Steelers would win the Super Bowl. This person still remains unnamed. But anyway, it's possible. I don't think it's likely, but it could happen. However, if this unnamed person also predicted the final score and then went on further and told us who would score and when during the course of the game, now, the likelihood of him being right would be astronomically against him. But that's exactly what the Bible did. The Bible was precise. It talked precisely about his death. It talked precisely about so many things. Precisely that he would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. So men continue all the time to make predictions over and over again, and once in a while, due to the law of averages, we're going to get one right. The Steelers could win the Super Bowl. It could happen. We live in a world that is changing more rapidly than the author of Future Shock could have even imagined in 1970. And the world that we live in today is nothing like the world that I grew up in. The world that we live in today is nothing like the world that our grandchildren and certainly our great-grandchildren will grow up in. We can't even begin to imagine what that world will look like. When I think about it, when my father was still alive in the year 2000, he was born in 1905. Virtually everything that he used on a daily basis, everything that was commonplace, everything that was part of our existence in the year 2000 didn't exist when he was born. And my mother certainly has gone through the same thing. She was born in 1910 and she's still alive. So we can imagine, and this was a period of time when there was great change. We look back 1905 till now, the world has changed dramatically, but now it's changing at a far more rapid pace. At times it's overwhelming, it's scary. But the kind of change that we see, we might buy a new iPod and before we get home with it, it's almost obsolete because they've been working on the new version before they got this one on the market. Same thing with cell phones. I just bought a new smartphone a couple of weeks ago. The next version, much better, is already out. You know, but you can't wait. The change just makes one's head spin. Now, this morning I'm going to change gears again, and I'm going to read a short article that appeared in February 2012 Guidepost. It's called The Intersection. Jumping out of my car, I clutched yet another envelope addressed to yet another personnel manager. Maybe this time I'll get a call, I thought as I ran into the post office. My job search had started a couple months back, and when I learned that the university where I'd been working for the last 2 years was going to eliminate my position. Yet no matter how many resumes I sent out, I didn't get a single response. I left the post office and headed to work. I came to the busy intersection I passed through every morning and scanned the faces of the pedestrians and school children waiting for the walk signal. Will I see my friend today, I wondered. He was near the rear of the pack. His legs seemed too short for his body, and he wobbled and swayed as he shuffled toward the opposite curb. His beard was flecked with gray. He seemed almost oblivious to what was going on. By the time he got to the middle of the intersection, everyone else had reached the other side. Just as he was in front of my car, the light turned green. Almost willing him to move, I watched as he finally made it to the curb and inched himself onto the sidewalk. At least no one had honked. Like every morning that I saw the stranger crossing the street, the same questions came to mind. Where does he live? Does he have a job, a family? How can I help him? I imagined his life wasn't an easy one. Lord, bless that man today and meet his every need. As I accelerated through the intersection, I wondered, why do I pray for him? Does it even make a difference? I'd lived and worked in this town my whole life. The only place I ever saw the man was at the intersection in the morning. At some point during the past 2 years, I began to think of him as a friend. That sense of connection spurred a desire to pray for him. It was strange because I could barely pray for myself. Were my prayers even heard? Now, I hadn't given up on God. I still went to church. One January night, the roads were snowy and it was late. I was late for service. I pushed open the front door, grateful for the warm air, pulled off my gloves, unwrapped my scarf, and looked around the packed sanctuary. The only free seats were in the front row. Wow, just like here. I rushed to the front while the organist started to play. Between hymns, people would stand up and tell how God had provided for them. That night, I found myself thinking, what about me? I felt like the kid who didn't know the password to the neighborhood club. Suddenly, a man spoke up with a voice I didn't recognize. I turned to see who it was. My friend from the intersection. What was he doing here? He put his hands on either side of the seat and shifted his weight forward until his feet touched the floor. I want to thank God, he began. I held my breath as he went on. He was thanking God because he had found a new apartment and a job. The service continued, but I didn't catch much of it. Instead, echoing in my head were that man's humble words of thanks. At the end of the sermon, the pastor invited anyone in the congregation to come up and pray. People filed forward, but I remained in my seat with my eyes closed. A moment later, there was a tap on my shoulder. Can you pray with me? My friend from the intersection looked into my eyes almost as if he knew me. He took my arm and led us to the altar. He knelt and bowed his head. I knelt beside him. I have no idea what I prayed that night. The words just formed inside of me. I felt like the Apostle Paul in Acts when he said, "For there stood me, by me this night, the angel of God." And when I finished praying, the man rose, squeezed my hand, and made his way out of the sanctuary into the cold, snowy night, back to his new apartment, his new job, his new life. He had been blessed. And I felt that in some way my prayers had been heard. Not long after that, I got a new job across town. That meant my morning commute no longer took me through that intersection, so I haven't seen my friend again. But I don't worry about him. There's a bond between us, one that goes deeper than I understand. This story tells me that there are no coincidences in life. we would like to call a lot of things that happened in this story just coincidences. But life doesn't just happen willy-nilly. God is in control. And many of the kinds of events like that that we would like to contribute to coincidences, I like to call God incidences. And now at this point of the message, this is the point where we find out why it's the mystery message. I guess by now you're wondering a couple things. Why the title, the mystery message, and the other one is, where is all this going? And if you're asking that question, this is exactly the same question I was asking God all week as he was feeding me things that needed to be in this message. I kept getting these thoughts of all these things that needed to be included, and I kept asking, what's the message? Where is this going? I have no clue. And then one evening, I read John chapter 5, verses 39 through 40, where Jesus says to the Jews, "You diligently study the scriptures because you think that by them you possess eternal life. These are the scriptures that testify about me, yet you refuse to come to me to have life." And what Jesus is saying, stop studying about me. Stop studying about my coming. I'm here. This is me. I've arrived. Come to me. And the whole purpose of prophecy, the whole purpose of all these things is to show that this God is fully in control. And now his son has arrived. There's no God, there's no coincidences, there's only God incidences. There's no predictions. These are fact. The Bible is filled with what we call prophecies, but they're not prophecy at all. They're fact. They're fact of things that have either happened or are going to happen. But God clearly knows. The scriptures could not be more clear that God knows the future. His predictions, like I said, are not predictions, they're facts. I talked about the fact that he predicted so many facts about Jesus hundreds of years in advance that there could be no doubt when he arrived. Yet there's still doubt today. The world may seem a little crazy and at times a whole lot crazy, because things are just happening so fast. Seems like we got to really hang on. It's like being on a fast spinning merry-go-round. But we have one solid thing in our lives. We have God, our God, who knows the future, who will always be there for us. And we can read such things as Deuteronomy 31:8. The Lord himself goes before you and will be with you. He will never leave you nor forsake you. Do not be afraid. Do not be discouraged. With all that goes on in the world, we can watch the news and we can become fearful. We can worry about what's going to happen after the next election, what's going to happen with the economy. God is in control. He's telling us again, stop worrying. I'm here. I told you I was coming. I came. I will never leave you. Joshua 1, verse 5, no one will be able to stand up against you all the days of your life. As I was with Moses, so I will be with you. I will never leave you nor forsake you. God clearly has a plan. His plan is to share his joy with us, to share his happiness with us, to share eternity with us. This God remains fully in control. But he does allow us to choose our own destinies. God creates situations every day where we come to forks in the road, crossroads, and he does that to give us that opportunity to make choices. We all have choices to make daily, sometimes hourly. It's up to us to make those choices. God has opened the door for us. He's here. He's promised us that he will protect us. All we have to do is reach out to him. I, for one, have certainly not made all the right choices in my life. I've come to many crossroads and made wrong turns, made many bad decisions in my life. but God continually gives us more and more opportunities to change. I took that opportunity. My life is different today. I hope I'm taking the right road. I hope I'm making the right turns most days. But I do know that I have a God to lean on, a God that is never changing, always the same, today, tomorrow, forever. And not only is He God, He's our God. Let's pray this morning. Dear Heavenly Father, we thank You so much for Your prophecy. We thank You for showing us daily, Lord, that You indeed are in control.